You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to an author debriefing from the International Spy Museum. I'm Mark Stout, the museum's historian. Here at the museum, we get the most interesting authors, including journalists, scholars, former spies, and intelligence officers, coming in to speak with our visitors and answer questions about their latest works dealing with espionage, intelligence, and other national security issues. Please join me in listening to another of our selected hour-long author debriefings.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the International Spy Museum. I'm the executive director, Peter Ernest. Our author today is Mike Sulick, who started off, I might add, in the Bronx and made his way eventually to CIA by way of having served in the Marine Corps during the Vietnam War. And he holds a PhD from City University in New York. So he falls into that category, I think, of a warrior scholar spy. Mike speaks Spanish, Polish, and Russian. He joined the CIA in 1980, served in what is the clandestine service, at that time the director of operations, later becoming the clandestine service, and then the national clandestine service. And he served in Japan, Peru, Poland, and Russia. And he rose to become, as you know, the ADDO, that is the assistant director of operations, before he left the agency in 2004. I happened to be in touch with Mike during that period following 2004. He was enjoying retirement. I think on the date I phoned him, his wife, Shirley, who is with us today, said, he is out floating in the pool, but I'll see if he'll come and talk to you. The other person who phoned him, I think either later that day or later, was General Mike Hayden, then the head of CIA, who asked Mike if he would come out of retirement and head up the clandestine service, the National Clandestine Service. And that was in 2007. Mike got out of the pool and graciously agreed to serve. And he then spent subsequently 3 years at the agency as the head of the clandestine service. The book, of course, that we are featuring today is his Spying in America. As Mike says himself in the introduction to the book, so often the press of events, particularly for those of us in the clandestine service, oftentimes interferes with what anyone else would call your professional reading. Many of our folks never got around to professional reading because they were doing cases. They were making what would become professional reading. And Mike said when he was in the service, he felt that there wasn't one place you could go and sort of have a very good recap of what had been espionage operations in this country, particularly from a counterintelligence point of view. And like other authors, he said, so there wasn't anything available, I decided to write a book, which he's done. It takes us up through World War II. I know he's working on Volume 2, which will pick up the period after that through today. His emphasis, as so many of us who ran cases had as an interest, is motivation. Why did people do what they did? And that will run like a thread all through the book. So, Michael, welcome to the museum. We're delighted to have you. Please help me welcome Michael Sulick. And this will be his book.
Thank you.
Good to see you, Mike. Okay. And this will be available for signing after his presentation.
Well, thanks very much, Peter, for that introduction, and thank you all for coming today. I see a lot of familiar faces in the crowd, colleagues as well as supervisors, mentors over the years. So now I realize that I probably will have a lot of things in that book that were wrong, and some of you may point out those mistakes to me, unfortunately. And I've got people here even ranging back to somebody I knew 45 years ago when we attended Vietnamese language school together in the Marine Corps. And I must say he's aged less gracefully than I have. But thank you also for coming out here in this. This is very lousy weather today, but it's actually good spying weather. At least I found it so when I was in Moscow years ago when it was snowing or raining. It was usually best time to operate there. But that gets me to the subject at hand, and that's this book. And I'm just going to go over some of the main points in it. I'll use a couple of the examples that I've used in the book of some of the cases. Every nation clearly has been a victim of espionage, not just the United States. You know, citizens betrayed secrets for all kind of motives. I'm obviously on this book focusing on American history, American espionage history, because that's what I know best, first of all. But it's also, our history as such is a little bit unique in its approach to spying. One of the common threads that I found in all of the cases, most of them, I should say, was disbelief. You know, Americans, more than any other nationality, seem to refuse to believe that their fellow Americans, their fellow citizens, would spy and betray the nation's secrets. Sometimes, even when they were confronted with irrefutable proof of this. And that disbelief kind of ironically stems from two very positive attributes of the United States. And one is its geography, exceptional geography in a sense. It's a land blessed with abundant resources, also had natural defenses on both sides, flanked by two huge oceans that essentially in the early years isolated us from the warring nations of Europe and some of the emerging nations in Asia. So for about the first 120 years of our existence as a nation, we really faced no threats from a foreign enemy, no major threats. And in many respects, it was a war among ourselves, the Tories versus revolutionaries in the Revolutionary War, and North versus South in the Civil War. And those clashes even affected families on both sides, where there was disputes within. Benjamin Franklin clearly was a great patriot. His son, however, William, was a rabid Tory and was the royal governor of the colony of New Jersey. In the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, his wife, had a brother and three half-brothers who fought on the Confederate side. And Lincoln also had a sister-in-law who used to smuggle medicine and supplies to Confederate forces. So we really weren't threatened by a foreign enemy in a major conflict until World War I. I don't really count the Spanish-American War as a major conflict. So it was natural that we really didn't believe in the threats of espionage. And one of the earliest examples of this was, a figure known to everybody here, a name known to every schoolboy, that's Benedict Arnold. Names synonymous in the United States with treason and espionage. But at the time he was spying, the colonials knew the British were trying to induce officers from the revolutionary side to defect, to spy for them. There was even information that they had bagged a highly placed general. George Washington and others knew that Arnold was involved in some shady business deals. Very resentful of the Continental Congress. They hadn't paid him money that he was owed. He felt they didn't really recognize his exploits that were actually very considerable. But still, when it turned out that he was a spy, Washington was and others were absolutely shocked. But if you fast forward 150 years later, basically the same thing occurred during the 1930s and 1940s when the Soviet Union probably had the largest network of spies maybe in its history, certainly largest network in U.S. history, over 500 Americans who were spying for the Soviet Union, many of them in FDR's administration, a number inside the Manhattan Project, which at that time was our most closely guarded secret. Then suddenly some defectors from the Soviet cause, people I'm sure probably well known to some of you here, Courier Elizabeth Bentley and another one, Whitaker Chambers, provided names and actually their stories kind of corroborated each other. Still later, the United States government develops really irrefutable proof of widespread espionage through something called the Venona Project, which, again, I think many of you probably know about here. For those who don't, the project was started after Stalin signed a non-aggression pact with Hitler. The U.S. Army began intercepting messages that were essentially transmitted over telephone lines from Soviet facilities in the United States, like its embassy and trade mission, to their headquarters in Moscow. And the messages kind of just piled up on Army desks. They were all enciphered, naturally. And it was only later in the war, when the United States had concerns that Stalin might make a separate peace with Hitler, that they began this arduous task of decrypting the messages and discovered, much to their chagrin, that the Soviet intelligence had spies inside the Manhattan Project. And as they worked more on this, they saw that the names that were given by Bentley and Chambers were, in fact, spies. But even then, some of the highest levels of the United States government refused to believe that. Now, the second reason for this disbelief that I talk about is also, again, ironically, one of our most cherished values, and that's our advocacy of individual liberties. Americans are basically, have always remained uncomfortable with espionage, with our collecting secrets, and also with counter-espionage, catching spies. And it's an attitude that I believe dates back to our first settlers. I mean, they came from Europe, many of them, to escape the oppression and the intrigue of the royal courts of Europe at the time. And espionage was obviously a key aspect of that statecraft, of those policies. So that really represented aspects of life that they wanted to escape when they fled to the New World. And as American history progresses, unfortunately, their suspicions turn out to be justified in many respects. Because aside from these disbelievers who refuse to see spies anywhere, there have always been throughout history, American history, kind of a minority of zealots who saw spies and saboteurs everywhere and that abused authority and violated civil rights in the name of catching spies. The first instance of this, which I deal with in this tome, was a gentleman named Lafayette Baker, who ran one of the two Union intelligence services in the Civil War, called the National Detective Police. And he went and rounded up alleged subversives and spies and detained them unlawfully, and in the process never really caught a real spy. Then again, you see history repeat itself right after World War I, when indeed there were anarchists and socialists who were organizing strikes in the United States, engaging in acts of violence. So the Attorney General at the time, a gentleman named Mitchell Palmer, who was also interested in getting a job at the White House, the presidency, he launched something called the Red Raids, which again would unlawfully detaining supposed subversives, saboteurs, and the like, and rounded up thousands. And he used a new outfit in the Department of Justice that at the time was called the Bureau of Investigation, that was led by a young lawyer named Leonardo DiCaprio. I'm sorry. Actually, it's J. Edgar Hoover, but I find when I talk to students sometimes, they know the actors better than the characters that they're portraying. But anyways, young, ambitious lawyer named J. Edgar Hoover, who was leading this Bureau of Investigation. Well, Palmer's dire warnings turned out to be overblown. He was discredited. His hopes for the White House were dashed. But it didn't end there. You know, there was anti-German hysteria before and during the World Wars, internment of Japanese Americans in World War II. And then you go forward a few decades, same J. Edgar Hoover organizes a program she calls COINTELPRO, which is short for Counterintelligence Program, where the FBI was seeking foreign spies, looking for a foreign hand in the civil rights and the peace movements. But in the end, really find no evidence of any major spies, either in Martin Luther King's entourage or in the peace movement. And finally, as recently as a decade ago, clearly there was a backlash in the country in the days following 9/11, anti-Arab backlash as well. But none of these movements, none of these zealot responses to these crises in our history really ever turned up any real major spies. So these suspicions and this disbelief also contributed to the absence of any real institutions to both collect intelligence as well as to catch spies, any counter-espionage. Americans would set up institutions in wartime, And once the war was over, they disbanded them and went off to their pursuits. Example is the first, the CIA actually acknowledges the kind of the first chief of counterintelligence, spy catching, to be John Jay. And he actually did have an organization and only operated in New York State during the Revolution. Obviously, the Revolution ends. He goes off to other pursuits and becomes the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, which probably left him a little more famous legacy than being head of counterintelligence. But it was an example of how people who got involved in this work went off to other pursuits. So every time a new conflict started, the United States had to kind of rebuild these capabilities anew. And the few institutions they did have were plagued by interagency rivalry and turf battles. I won't deny that sometimes even today some of that happens, but it's certainly far less than it was at that time. In the Civil War, the Union had two counterintelligence services, basically, one that I mentioned run by Mr. Baker, Lafayette Baker, and the other one by Alan Pinkerton, who would later, of course, become the head of the foremost detective agency in the United States. But these two services would sometimes stumble over each other. They even arrested each other's own agents at times, and some of the stories about them were really like the Keystone Cops. But that's in the Civil War. But even you know, fast forward ahead to World War I and its aftermath, there are turf battles between the Department of Justice, which has Hoover's Bureau of Investigation, and the Treasury Department, which had the Secret Service. The both of them kind of vying with President Wilson to gain control of authorities in counterespionage. And they both did have actually limited authorities. Finally, the dispute settled before World War II when Franklin Roosevelt invested the a legal authority in the FBI for spy catching in the United States. Now, in the cases that I deal with in this book, I kind of, as I say in the introduction, I deal with kind of six elements, to me, the basic elements of espionage, the spy cases. Motive, as Peter mentioned before, access, you know, what secrets did these people have access to, and what did they share with their masters. Tradecraft, which, as everybody here knows, kind of the art science of clandestinity, how you communicate with your spies, your sources, without getting caught. Then exposure, how they were caught, punishment, and finally damage. What damage do they really do to national security? Motive, just like around the world, American spies decided to betray secrets for the same reasons that people do around the globe: money, ideology, thrills, ego, resentment, dual loyalties. What do you think is the, out of those that I just named, what do you think is the main one? I know everybody's going to get this right, so just a little interaction with the audience. And you guys, you're kind of hesitant, you know. It's like, nobody ever gets that wrong. Yeah, money. It's money, but at the same time, as we know, like I see I have a number of my FBI colleagues in the audience as well, too. But, you know, we kind of know that it's often a combination of those. Motives, not just money alone. The first major spy in the Revolutionary War is a gentleman named Benjamin Church. On the surface, he was a leading patriot. He was a doctor at Bunker Hill, cured the wounded there. Washington appointed him Surgeon General of the Army. He was the colony of Massachusetts, chose him as their liaison, if you will, their representative to the other colonies. He's a member of the Colonial Underground, the Sons of Liberty. At the same time, he had a mistress. He liked the high life. Physicians weren't paid the enormous salaries that they sometimes command today, so he didn't have that much money, so he decided to spy for the British. Benedict Arnold, you know, also offered his services to the British for money. But his case kind of also illustrates what I said before, that, you know, it's a combination of motives that really impel people to spy. He clearly spied for money, but he had a lot of the other motives that I mentioned before. He's resentment over the unfair treatment by Congress. He had been passed over for promotion, not recognized for his exploits. So his motives were really a kind of a mixture of things. And money for him was, you know, he had debts. He wanted more money. So clearly it was a main motivation. But in a sense, money was something even more to him. It was a kind of a recognition of his self-worth, you know, recognition that he felt had been denied him by his own people in the colonies. Now, not all Americans spied for money. In the Civil War, pretty much the vast majority of those who were spies did so out of loyalty to the Union or to the Confederate cause. But among the unique period, I think, in American history or American espionage history is in the 1930s and 1940s. You know, it's the Depression. Capitalism doesn't seem to be working. The Soviet Union has just, formed a few decades before. A lot of propaganda about its economic successes, gargantuan steel mills that are producing. And Stalin is also seen as a bulwark against fascism that's on the rise in Europe. So communism is kind of an attractive alternative to a number of Americans. And you have hundreds of sympathizers who flock to work for the New Deal in the Roosevelt administration. A lot of them started out in Marxist discussion groups, a number of which evolved into spy networks. And some of the people were actually, when the Soviets offered them payment, they were insulted by it. And a lot of them also were members of the Communist Party, so actually paid dues for the privilege of spying rather than receiving any money. Now, access. Let me just say a little bit about this. One of our former CIA directors, Alan Dulles, said, intelligence is really, espionage is all about access. What secrets do you know that you can give to your masters? Clearly, Benedict Arnold, highest ranking spy in American history, had access to a number of the colonials' war plans. But there are others like Harry Dexter White, who was one of the most senior officials in the Treasury Department during this Soviet golden age of espionage. He's also the architect of the International Monetary Fund and a Soviet spy. Alger Hiss, high-ranking State Department official, was in the forefront of the U.S. delegation at the establishment of the UN during the talks in San Francisco. But there are also a number of little gray men and women who are aides and advisors and clerks as well. One example I used early on in this book is a gentleman named Edward Bancroft. He was a spy for the British while he was an aide to Benjamin Franklin in Paris. Franklin was there to try to organize covert support from the French to the colonies. Lachlan Curry, an advisor to Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in the White House. And another case I deal with Judith Copeland, who was a clerk in the Department of Justice, where she had access to FBI files that she shared liberally with Soviet intelligence. But then there are others that I mentioned before who had no direct access to secrets at all, but helped basically facilitate spy operations. Elizabeth Bentley, who was a courier, Whitaker Chambers. But my favorite, I think, in all of these is in the Civil War, a Union spy named Elizabeth Van Loo. No direct access to any kind of secrets at all, but organized a very effective network. And I, probably of all the ones I deal with in this book, I found her to be the most innovative spy, if you will. I mean, it's the middle of the 19th century. She's a single woman, no training, experience in espionage, abhors slavery. She lives in the heart of the Confederacy in Richmond and decides to spy, offer her services to the Union. She develops her own set of codes, uses secret writing and invisible ink, and develops kind of a layered system of redundant security measures. Not only enciphers all this information, but she splits the messages into sections and sends them along various routes. So if somebody's caught, the whole message won't be compromised. Sets up a courier system of way stations along these routes and uses farmers and merchants. But probably most ingenious of all, she uses slaves to do it. And obviously in the South at that time, people did not consider slaves really intelligent enough that they could participate in intelligence operations. And one of her real coups was she sent one of her slaves north for an education. And when the lady came back, Van Loo placed her as a maid in the home of Jefferson Davis, obviously the president of the Confederacy. So you can imagine what she picks up around the dinner table as Davis is sitting there with his cabinet and his generals, and all of them looking at her is just another piece of the furniture. Right, let me talk a little bit about tradecraft. As I said, this is kind of the art of clandestinity to ensure the safety of your sources, which is, in my old business, the CIA was a moral imperative. The greatest risk in spy operations, of course, communications. At some point, the spy has to have some kind of contact with his handler, his spy masters, if you will, to pass information, receive questions, money, or what other materials are necessary. So tradecraft involves all the tricks of the game that a lot of you already here in the audience know: code, ciphers, secret writings, invisible ink, dead drops, and so on. Dead drops being pre-designated spots where a cache of information will be left, spots known only to the spy and to his spy handlers. Interestingly, that method goes back even to the days of the Revolutionary War. I mentioned the case of Edward Bancroft before. He was in Paris with Benjamin Franklin. The French and the British were rivals at the time. The French security service clearly was paying a close attention to the British that were in the country. So obviously the British didn't want to be seen meeting with one of Franklin's closest aides. So they actually used dead drops. Every Tuesday night, Bancroft would go to a popular Paris park with a bottle. He would put his information inside there, tie a rope around it, on the other end tie it to a twig, put the bottle in a hollow of a tree, where only the twig was showing. And then an hour later, British intelligence officer would come, take that twig, take the bottle out, put whatever questions he had or any money, whatever, in the bottle, where Bancroft would later come and then retrieve it again. Now, this is the same method actually used by not only my colleagues in the KGB to have contact with their agents in Washington and elsewhere through the Cold War, but the CIA used the same methods in Moscow as well. So they're kind of time-tested and true. Now, tradecraft, say that leads to the next element I discussed, which is exposure. Clearly, if you don't take these measures seriously, you don't do them right, that leads to the exposure of your sources. This happened number of times, as I point out in the book and the cases I deal with. The example I'll cite here with the Germans, because nobody likes a Nazi, so it's easy to pick on them. They had some successes spying against the United States before and during both world wars, but overall, their espionage in the United States was pretty, their tradecraft, their security was pretty shoddy and actually led to the exposure of a lot of their sources and key intelligence operations. They never really evaluated the Americans they recruited as spies or saboteurs. Clearly, they looked for spies in the German-American communities in the United States. They thought they could find somebody who might have dual loyalties. They were very successful in one case, a gentleman named Hermann Lang, a German-American in New York City who frequented some of the German-American haunts in the neighborhood. Lang was an engineer in a company called the Norden Company that was owned and run by another immigrant whose name was Carl Norden. Now, Norden had invented a device that was named after him called the Norden Bomb Sight, which at the time was a major development in kind of the new arena of aerial bombardment in the early days of air warfare. Basically, the concept was the higher a plane flies, drops a bomb, the more inaccurate it is. The lower it flies, the more accurate it is, but it's more vulnerable to ground fire. So Norden basically solved the problem. He knew a lot about gyroscope technology and applied that to design this platform, this device that wouldn't be affected by the changing position of an airplane. Now, this was actually considered a very deeply guarded secret. There were all kinds of security rules about access and information on this particular weapon and what to do if you were shot down, you were a pilot, how to destroy it, and so on. But Lang worked at the factory, had access to the blueprints, took them home, drew them, and then gave them to the Nazis, mainly because he felt someday his motherland, Germany, might need them. He really wasn't stridently anti-American or anything at the time. The Nazis that received this, fortunately for us, they never learned how to mass produce it. But that was a success, and it was kind of unique. More typical of German espionage was the case of a gentleman named William Siebold, who was another German who had emigrated to the United States, returns on a trip to Germany in 1939 to visit his mother. German intelligence basically pulls him aside and blackmails him into cooperating with them. They said they knew that he had lied on his visa application when he first had entered the United States. He had some kind of a minor arrest in Germany, and they said they would basically rat him out but blackmailed him. So he's caught, he agrees to do it, He has to spend a few more months beyond his vacation with his mother in Germany to learn how to operate a radio. He's basically going to be the communicator. So he does this. He comes back to the States, sets up a front office in Manhattan, a radio station in his home in Long Island, and eventually there's a whole stream of Nazi agents bringing him information to send back to Berlin. Suddenly, in July of 1941, the FBI swoops in and arrests over 30 Nazi spies. Hitler is reportedly furious. German intelligence is devastated. You know, how could this happen? They find out as they watch the trial take place, and the star witness for the prosecution is William Sebald. He essentially had become a double agent. After he was blackmailed, he told the Nazis he had to go to the U.S. Embassy to wire some money back to his wife, reported the entire approach, and agreed to work for the FBI. The FBI not only sent all his radio messages, but they wired his office in Manhattan up with audio devices and cameras to basically record the evidence of these 30-plus people who came to this office to bring information. It was a major Nazi mistake. I think bred of, you know, their arrogance. They believed that anybody with German blood, any true Aryan, would probably willingly serve the fatherland, even if he was blackmailed. So they did no basic background checks, something you would certainly do with somebody who's going to be a communicator, who's going to have all this access to this information from all these spies. Then they compound the mistake by exposing him to basically the entire network so he can identify them all to the FBI and facilitate their videotaping of him. So on the eve of American entry into World War II, Nazi eyes and ears in the United States basically go blind and deaf. And this happens with other operations that they do throughout the war, too, which I describe in that book. Now, Soviet intelligence had serious problems with tradecraft and security as well, with their, you know, network of spies in the United States. These networks, as I said, kind of evolved from Marxist discussion groups, and they never really abandoned this coffee klatch approach to spying. KGB constantly tried to get them to improve their security, but these are American citizens. They were in America. They felt they knew their environment better. They also had considerable influence. Those in the Communist Party of the USA had considerable influence back in Moscow. So the members kind of did what they wanted. They knew each other. They typed each other's information. They talked by phone. There was one spy, but he was working for the GRU, who decided he would recruit another one of his fellows to be a spy. He thought this guy was sympathetic, and he made the approach to him, and the guy told him, "That's too late. I'm already working for the KGB." So it's not quite the way to run the railroad, but again, and of course, the GRU handlers and KGB handlers were horrified when they heard that story, but these things like this happened a lot then. You wonder, well, how were they able to operate so easily and I can get away with all this? Well, at the time, the FBI was kind of preoccupied with other things. They were trying to find the likes of John Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde and, crime in the United States. And also, their main focus as far as foreign targets were German and Japanese, because this was the emerging enemy and eventually the enemy. And Soviets, of course, had been, became our allies in World War II. But because of this poor security, somebody like Elizabeth Bentley, who's a courier, when she goes to the FBI, she basically reveals the specific identities of 80 Americans who are spying for the Soviets, 27 of whom are working inside the United States government. Punishment for these spies when they're caught. The punishment varied often depending on a number of factors throughout history, and sometimes would reflect the particular political dynamics of the era when the spies were caught. In the Revolutionary War, when Church was caught, Washington himself and others wanted to string up Benjamin right away, hang him from the highest yardarm, and then they realized they had no espionage law. So they quickly had to devise one. Well, by the time of the Civil War, nobody really paid attention to that espionage law. Minor spies on both sides were usually just simply released because neither the Union or the Confederacy really had the money, wanted to spend the money to feed them. So they'd let them go. In some cases, however, depending on the whim of the local commander, they were hung. Now, this haphazard approach kind of ended with the onset of World War I when the Espionage Act is enacted in 1917. But as I said, punishment often reflects the political dynamics or the context of the time, and the best illustration of that is probably, you know, one of the most famous spy cases, or famous any criminal case in American history, and that's Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. By the time of their trial, the U.S. flirtation with communism has ended. Soviets are no longer an ally but an adversary. They've occupied Eastern Europe, tested an atomic bomb based on secrets they stole from us. Mao Zedong is on the rise in China, and the Korean War is ongoing. So in this heated, very anti-Soviet, anti-communist climate at the time, Rosenbergs are not only convicted but executed for espionage, sparking a controversy, a debate that's lasted for years. Clearly, people on the left said this was, they were innocent victims of right-wing hysteria. Those on the right said they were just evidence of a growing, widespread cancer of communism in American society. This debate lasted for years. Eventually, number of sources, the Venona Project was declassified. Soviet defectors came forth. The Rosenbergs' own case officer, Mr. Feklisov, you know, wrote a book about them, or in which he wrote a book about his career in which he discussed them. And even Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev acknowledged their contribution. But in spite of that, just a few years ago, 2008, when their two sons came forth and said that they finally admitted that their parents were spying, although they kind of wanted to deny that for years. But despite that, there is still a debate over the severity of their sentences, especially about Ethel Rosenberg. She was clearly a dedicated communist, knew her husband was spying, but during their trial, there was very little evidence of her collaboration in the spy efforts of this. But when she was sentenced to death, even J. Edgar Hoover, who was, you know, somebody hardly called anti-communist, actually opposed a death penalty for her because he felt the image of their, you know, their two orphan children would probably hinder FBI efforts in the future on in spy catching. And you see later in the Cold War, which I don't treat in this book, but in the sequel, if you will, there were spies who did equal or you could say even more damage than the Rosenbergs. A case that jumps to mind is John Walker, of course, who betrayed our military codes and compromised secrets of our sea-based nuclear missiles, which at that time were, you know, the most invulnerable leg of our triad of sea-based, air-based, and land-based missiles. He's convicted, but life imprisonment, not sentenced to death. So the issue in the Rosenberg debate, which applies to all these cases, what is the damage that were caused to national security? I mean, Rosenberg himself did not have any direct access to any nuclear or any atomic bomb secrets. He recruited his brother-in-law, David Greenglass, who was a mechanic in Los Alamos, who had only a limited knowledge of what he was working on. And he clearly wasn't the only one who gave information about the atomic bomb. There were other spies, you know, like Klaus Fuchs, a British scientist who worked on the project, a Soviet illegal named George Koval, who actually provided what was known as a plutonium trigger that was key to the detonation of the bomb, and another spy named Ted Hall, who was kind of a child genius who graduated from Harvard at 15 years old or something, a real genius in physics, and worked on what was called the implosion method, which is the real breakthrough in the bomb design. So, again, the issue of what damage did these spies really cause. Some historians say that, you know, atomic bomb was probably the most egregious secret to leak out. Some historians believe that Stalin felt emboldened as a result of the atomic bomb test that the Soviets conducted based on their development of the bomb, of their own version. And as a result of that, he sanctioned that North Korean invasion, a war that wound up with 4 million casualties and the deaths of over 30,000 or 35,000 U.S. servicemen. But overall, you know, espionage, as interesting as it is, really doesn't change the course of events. You know, the nation still got its independence in spite of Benedict Arnold. The Union persevered despite Confederate spying. We survived two world wars in spite of enemy spies. and the Soviet Union eventually went into the dustbin of history, although they had certainly done quite a spy job on us throughout the Cold War. That said, though, espionage does take its toll, and I write about this more in the second volume, because there are cases where spies gave up secrets that resulted in the loss of American life. I'll point to as one example the case of John Walker. Among the information he gave was information which we presume, I guess, the Soviets passed to the Vietnamese during the Vietnam conflict, and that enabled them to shoot down a lot of our pilots over Vietnam. Some, of course, died, and others spent time in the Hanoi Hilton and years in prison. So, but let me leave it at this point. I'll take any questions you have, any errors, any complaints. Any complaints, please direct them to Peter.
First of all, thank you so much, Mike, for a really terrific presentation. Okay.
Check.
Okay, if you would, please just wait for the microphone so everyone can hear the question. We'll get to as many of you or all of you as we can. Why don't we start right here?
Yeah, hi. You mentioned
the mic,
please. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You mentioned the Espionage Act of 1917. Now, that is still the act that's being used to prosecute espionage. How come Congress has not updated that? It just seems that there's a lot more to espionage than it's probably contained in that act.
Yeah, you're going to have to answer for Congress now, too, Michael. Yeah.
Congress, dysfunctional. That's why. They can't handle a fiscal cliff. How are they going to handle espionage? No, but that act, actually, there have been updates to that act over the years, things like classified identities, procedures, there have been additions made to the act's been revised over the years, sometimes to stiffen the penalties more, so on. So,
okay, questions? One all the way in the back, right next to you, Amanda. All yes, right, yes. Okay, and then Mark had one.
You mentioned, I think, that Soviet espionage was more successful because of ideology in this country, like 30s and 40s and things like that, as opposed to money. Other things. I recently saw a cartoon that was Civil War Reconstruction period that said or talked about the communist threat. And do you think there was almost a organic, almost indigenous communist growth in this country from the time of Marx, maybe in the 1840s, that really contributed to the great success of Soviet espionage in the 30s and 40s?
No, I think that even early on there was interest in communism, but it really doesn't evolve into a movement that attracts a lot of people until the Great Depression, because a lot of people question whether capitalism versus communism. The capitalist system clearly isn't working. Millions of people unemployed, and I think that's what sparks, because then you have a wider sections of society that, it's agrarian people, farmers attracted to it, students and intellectuals. The movement spreads beyond what it probably was in the 19th century when the first interest in it starts in the United States. But I do want to, I guess, amend this a little bit. In the 1930s and 40s, yes, ideology, but by the time the 50s come, I mean, I think the Soviets kind of caught on fast that they abandoned using the Communist Party of the United States as kind of a breeding ground, a spotting ground, a seeding mechanism. The movement was totally penetrated by the FBI. In fact, there was some who used to joke that if the FBI stopped, who had infiltrated the Communist Party, stopped paying their dues, the party would probably fold. So they knew that they couldn't use that anymore. They also said, it's kind of dollars, not doctrine, now that attracts people. So what they start doing is going after people in the military, because they're concerned, obviously, about a military confrontation. And they see that money is going to be a bigger motive for Americans, that their ideology holds no attraction any longer, which is, in fact, the case.
Mark.
Mike, thanks for a really interesting talk and what promises to be a useful book. This may be a real simple question for you to dispose of. I'm not sure. In the period of history that's, I guess, you're going to cover in Volume 2, there have been quite a number of cases of, you know, smaller powers who have run espionage operations against us. South Africa, I know one or two sub-Saharan African countries, Israel, I guess the Dutch ran a guy in the NSA for a while. In the period that your book covers, are there any sort of quirky little cases where, you know, the Portuguese or the sort of stand out that weren't really about the big power politics of the day? Or is that a much more recent sort of post-World War II phenomenon?
Yeah. There may have been. I can't think of any off the top of my head. But the fact is, since we had no counter-espionage service as such, there could have been, and we just don't know about them. I mean, I can only write about the cases that we know about. You know, so a lot of people probably escaped unheard of. But, yeah, there it's... I think the National Counterintelligence Executive said a few years ago, something like 40 nations actively spying against the United States. So during the Cold War days or in the latter part, you got nations like, I mean, Ghana actually had somebody inside the CIA for a while. That's almost an insult, Ghana. Don't we be able to... Ecuador.
Okay, Matt, all the way in the back there. Yeah.
A country you did not talk about was Great Britain. There was a military liaison between the time Britain declared war on Germany and Pearl Harbor. Did any of the activities of this British military presence cross over into espionage?
Okay, I have to clarify.
The British were gathering intelligence in the United States prior to Pearl Harbor, and some of it was above board of influencing American public opinion. But did any of it actually cross over into outright espionage?
No, I mean, I know of no cases of any, let's say, major spy who was working for British intelligence. Again, because we were cooperating with the British, they could. I think the Americans they dealt with were talking pretty freely to them, you know, envisioning them as they were our allies, but envisioning them as wartime allies as well. So, no.
Another one? Okay, right here.
Yeah, I did hear of a book that this woman wrote about this British military attaché here during the time of World War II who was interested in going to a lot of cocktail parties and the like, getting information and trying to influence, the U.S. being supportive of the British and that kind of thing. That was kind of a quasi-spying, but they tried to influence.
Yeah, but I don't see that as any major spy. I'm talking about somebody who says, I will betray American secrets for you, British military intelligence attaché.
Meta, yeah.
Hi, Mike. Are there lessons for today, either in intelligence gathering or counterintelligence, that you learned doing your research?
Well, again, as I stress that common thread of disbelief, there is a tendency of Americans to think their fellow citizens are basically good people and would never go so far as to betray this wonderful country. So... I think that still persists. I mean, even in my old organization, counterintelligence is always something people are nervous about because, they're the naysayers, they're the, sometimes obstructionists. They want to take a step back and look at everything subjectively. So I think, that's the lesson is, especially after, Americans are a lot smarter now. You see what happened during the 1930s and 40s, and they saw the vast extent of Soviet espionage. I think we're a little smarter about it now, too. But still, there are pockets sometimes who just don't believe it or don't want to believe it, but it persists.
Hi, just a couple short questions. When you talked about zealots who saw, spies everywhere, I didn't hear you mention James Jesus Angleton, but is that just because he was later... time? Maybe that's for the second book? I don't know.
There will be a whole chapter in the second book.
And two, I remember reading in Kim Philby's memoir that he had helped prepare exfiltrations for other people involved with the Rosenberg same spy ring, and that he had neglected to do one for them since he thought they were so such minor characters as to not even merit any real interest, and that he regretted that the rest of his life. Is that
so
at
that
all true?
I didn't hear that
he Philby had not developed any sort of plan to exfiltrate the Rosenbergs because he thought they were such minor functionaries that they wouldn't receive a whole lot of attention.
The Soviets actually did want to exfiltrate them, and the Rosenbergs were kind of resisting until it became almost too late. They were going to exfiltrate not only the Rosenbergs, but brother-in-law David Greenglass and his wife. And Greenglass's wife suffered serious burns and a fire in her kitchen, so she couldn't travel. So they put it off for a couple of more months, and actually by then it really was too late. And that's, of course, they got arrested.
Yeah, one right here, Mike.
Mr. Solik, I'm looking forward to read your book. Question, what do you think of WikiLeaks and the new electronic age making easier for spies to spy and government and private sector?
Yeah, no, it's clearly very serious. You know, the amount of information that you can, you know, a spy can get put on a flash drive now would take, you know, a legion of spies to collect. I think one kid, Jonathan Pollard case, you're probably familiar with, who spied for Israel. I mean, he used to lug suitcases full of information out of his office, and was actually caught because he was spotted in somebody, one of his colleagues, so he was a little suspicious bringing all his stuff out. Nowadays, he could just walk out with that in his, you know, in his shirt pocket through the use of a flash drive. It's, you know, clearly a lot more serious. On WikiLeaks itself, I think it's what's interesting about that phenomenon, I think, is that it's going to be a lot harder, I think, in the future to try cases on this when people say, I am exposing it. I'm not giving it, selling something to a foreign power. I'm just exposing, you know, whatever is wrong with the United States government or whatever they're doing wrong. And even though they may be leaking classified information, juries are not necessarily going to, you know, want to hang them the same way as somebody who's selling secrets to Iran or selling secrets to Chinese, you know, nuclear secrets to China or something. So I think those cases are going to be a little bit more difficult in days to come. I mean, you see, I don't know whether Bradley Manning is innocent. That's up to the tribunal to determine that. But you see, he's got a lot of supporters out there, and as does Julian Assange, too. So I think this is, you know, the activities of places like Anonymous and so on are going to be a lot more difficult to kind of thwart in that area as we go along.
Okay, one last question right back here.
Hi, if I may, I would like to ask two questions. You mentioned as an aside that intelligence really hasn't changed history, and I think it's in the public record that we spent over $80 billion worth on the intelligence apparatus. It begs the question, at what point does it become prohibitively too costly to spend on the intelligence bureaucracy? And the second question is, have we given enough thinking about how to retire former spies? Not everybody could write a book about the spy business. And what prompts this question is...
Actually, I think everybody can. And almost everybody has.
Point well taken. But case, what prompts that question is the role that the KGB has played in Putin coming to power in Russia. And you do wonder whether we could have done a better job dismantling the KGB to prohibit somebody like Putin coming to power again.
Well, it certainly wasn't up to us to dismantle the KGB. I mean, this was up to the Russian people, really, to do that. I do remember one of my... former supervisors, I can quote him here, Milt Bearden, when we first started dealing with Eastern Europe and the Russians, he said, we'll tell them about how we organize an intelligence system in a democratic society. We'll teach them about congressional oversight. And he said, they'll never be a threat to anybody again forever once that happens. So,
Okay, Mike Sulick, thank you so much for a terrific presentation this afternoon.
I hope you enjoyed this author debriefing. We'd like to know if you have any questions or comments about it. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. We look forward to you joining us again for another of our author debriefings, and thanks for listening.